We're talking about the politicization of our nation's highest court and what reforms could boost the Supreme Court's institutional legitimacy. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, thanks for being here. President Biden's Commission on the Supreme Court dug into this with a 288-page final report published in December. And the upshot was the 34 prominent legal scholars, think all law professors, basically, they couldn't find common ground on how to fix SCOTUS. But they did present a whole menu of options, and we'll look at some of those ideas along with yours. Do you have confidence in the Supreme Court, or do you think it has become too political? What reforms are needed and why? 800-642-1234. Sarah Turberville is director of the Constitution Project, which is part of the Project on Government Oversight, a nonpartisan watchdog group, and she focuses on democratic institutions, the separation of powers, and protection of constitutional rights. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Well, your sense here first, is the Supreme Court at a crossroads? What is this moment we are at as a nation and how it treats the judicial branch of government?
I think that we are at a crossroads of some kind. And unfortunately, due to the political polarization in our country, you know, sort of what that looks like might depend on your political persuasion. But I don't think, you know, that we would have had this presidential commission on the Supreme Court if there wasn't kind of a widespread understanding that something is amiss in the way that Supreme Court selection has unfolded, particularly over the last several decades, and the impact that has had on the public's faith in the institution.
Hmm. How would you grade the commission's work and its December report? Some critics have called the academics paralysis by analysis, that they clung to status quo. What was your take?
Well, I think in a way it was set up to be that way. So, you know, President Biden signed an executive order creating the commission. The executive order never asked for the commission to develop recommendations or endorse or, you know, come up with a slate of recommendations that it would endorse. And I think what we saw over the, 6 to 8 months that the commission engaged in its work was an incredibly thoughtful process, but one that, I think there was certainly a reliance on the fact that they were not going to have to make recommendations that made the group sort of settle into essentially creating a very robust and thorough book report on Supreme Court reform.
It's like, hey, you know, we're law professors. We're good at showing precedent. We're good at talking about history, but we're just going to lay it out for you and then you make a decision.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there was nothing was compelling them to have to coalesce around any particular reforms. And so that's why, in a way, this, I think, developed the way that it did. From President Biden's perspective, right, if they had endorsed reforms and recommendations, then that was really going to put the administration in the seat of having to see some of that move forward, too. So, I think that the commission was created out of a campaign promise that the president had made. It had people with a wide variety of perspectives who, you know, were fairly entrenched in some of their views. So I just don't know if this was ever something that was going to move the ball.
We're talking with Sarah Turberville, director of the Constitution Project, part of the nonpartisan Project on Government Oversight, as we look at potential ways to change the U.S. Supreme Court. And hearing your insights, your ideas, 800-642-1234. Sarah, you've been writing about how the court is broken and that it needs reform. What is wrong with the way it is functioning?
So the structure of our Supreme Court is unique among sort of, you know, state Supreme Courts, the way that they function across the United States, as well as across modern democracies. We have a court that, by my assessment, it is essentially comprised of too few people who hold too much power for too long. So reforms need to address those structural deficiencies, because it is that concentration of power that leads to the Senate and, you know, other political interests and special interests to treat the court like a political football. You know, because essentially, if you can capture the Supreme Court, you can entrench your power long beyond sort of the last time that you've won an election.
Well, in Democrats and Republicans, they often describe the whole process, confirmation process as broken, but they typically blame the other side for the deterioration of the whole process of the Supreme Court and who is on it. So who or what is at fault here?
I think we've got, so there's some structural problems, right? So if we're looking at how long the justices are now serve on the court, you know, I think there's been an emphasis. It's no secret, right, that that presidents have sought to find younger and younger nominees to place on the Supreme Court with the expectation that they will have a long tenure.
They'll be there a really, really long time.
They'll be there a really, really long time. And you know, another component of this that's a little bit newer, so I would say in the last like couple decades, is the idea that the Republicans in particular have been very effective at finding sort of more hardened ideologues to nominate for the bench. So, you know, I've listened to the former White House counsel for Donald Trump, Don McGahn, who was responsible for shepherding both Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh through the confirmation process, say that, you know, they want to know who these people are so that they don't have any more ciphers nominated to the court. You know, they don't have any more people whose positions could potentially involve and change over the decades that they spend on the Supreme Court, which is sort of anathema to what we think of when we think of what courts do, is that they're supposed to exercise independent judgment. They're supposed to be above the fray, above the political fray. And so I think these two factors of how long justices will be on the court, combined with the efficacy that Republicans in particular have been able to find sort of more ideologically hardened individuals to be on the court, has really brought us to this precipice.
Well, let's bring on a caller. Jim is with us from Hartford. Jim, hi, what are your thoughts?
Hi, Kate. My thoughts are to the contrary. I see that all the Democratic nominations are the ones who are trying to change the Constitution. They're trying to bypass the actual Constitution. And the Republicans, yeah, they've been trying to get ideologues just like the Democrats, but they're the ones who are adhering to the written Constitution, where the Democrats are trying to evolve from the Constitution. And I don't think your group's very nonpartisan, just by the way your guest is talking. That's pretty much what I got to say.
Okay, Jim, thank you for those insights. Jim is saying that there is this tension getting away from the Constitution and adhering, you know, Republicans adhering perhaps to originalism. Sarah, what do you have to say there?
Sure, and I appreciate what the caller's saying. I think, you know, I pointed out Republicans because I think Republicans have been more effective at finding ideologues. I don't think that the Democrats have clean hands here by any stretch. So there's, you know, but I would add that there have been, it is, what I'm talking about is the power of the court itself, right? I mean, this is an institution whose decisions loom so large over the lives of Americans. And it's that concentration of power sort of turns our whole separation of power system on its head, right? It's supposed to be the Congress that makes policy. And, you know, you can look back at, you know, recent fights where we have seen members of Congress speak to the fact that they want to see the Supreme Court strike down the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, what's concerning to me about that is that if that's the obligation of the Congress to do, right? That's what Article 1 of the Constitution sets out for our national legislature to do, to make policy. It's not the Supreme Court's job to make policy.
Sarah Turberville, director of the Constitution Project at the Project on Government Oversight, that is a nonpartisan group that investigates corruption, investigates misconduct, conflicts of interest in the federal government. Should the High Court be restructured? And if so, how? Why? Has the court become too ideological, too rigid in approaches? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Should there be more than 9 Supreme Court justices? What about term limits? SCOTUS has come under heightened political scrutiny. We're talking about what reforms are on the table on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden's commission, as we've been talking about, on reforming the Supreme Court, they acknowledged in their report that there is profound disagreement over whether court expansion at this moment would be wise. And these law professors, they stayed out of the fray, writing they take no position on the wisdom of expansion. Do you think court expansion or court packing would undermine or enhance the highest court? Join in 800-642-1234. Sarah Turberville is director of the Constitution Project and with us for the hour. Sarah, one of the changes that many on the left are urging for Democrats is to, quote, pack the court. What is court packing first?
It is an expansion of the number of seats that would be on the Supreme Court. So presently, it's set at 9. Congress sets the number, traditionally has set the number of seats on the Supreme Court. It's been as few as 6. In our country's history, and as much as 10. And of course, I think a lot of folks are you know, familiar with the story of during the Roosevelt administration, where he had threatened to pack the court because of some of the decisions that were coming down, overturning components of the New Deal, and ultimately would step back from that threat after the court sort of reversed itself. So this is something that is certainly gaining traction. It's not something I could have ever imagined that would be in the public's appetite just even a few years ago. But I think it's a reaction to some of the recent confirmation battles and some of the decisions that have come down from the court over the last several years in particular, that people are very, you know, and a number of progressives are very concerned about what those decisions mean for the lives of Americans.
Do you think that court packing, court expansion is a good idea?
It depends. I don't tend to agree that it's a good idea sort of as a like reflexive reaction to decisions that the courts issued that you don't like. I do think a gradual expansion of our Supreme Court is not a bad idea for the purpose of allowing the court to sit in panels. Most state Supreme Courts, for example, do not hear cases where every single person on the bench hears every single case. Most other countries, you know, constitutional courts don't operate the way our Supreme Court does. Instead, they have, you know, an expanded number of seats on the bench, and cases are heard by like a randomly drawn panel of judges. And, you know, you could see a lot of benefits to doing something like that, because it's going to be much more difficult to sort of predict kind of exactly how a case will come down. It would ideally incentivize the judges to moderate their positions a little bit more, because they will have to persuade different people. So I think you would have more dynamic decision making. So I think So court packing is kind of, you know, as a reflexive reaction to sort of decisions of the court, I think not good, but as a way to get the court to function in a more dynamic way, I think would be a good idea.
So what about the Supreme Court being elected? Should our country's Supreme Court be elected like we see with Wisconsin Supreme Court justices are?
I think judicial elections are a very dangerous thing. Mm. Our project put together a report last summer where we had judges, former state Supreme Court justices who have had to run for office, and also some who have gone through an appointment process. And I think, you know, there's just universal agreement among people who have been through this process that judicial elections are a very toxic thing. You don't want your judges to have constituents and constituent interests that they should be looking out for, or that they have to look out for when they're deciding cases. I think that judicial elections are extremely, you know, are a big threat to the judicial independence of judges, whether they be, you know, a trial judge in a county in Wisconsin, or whether they be a Supreme Court justice at the Supreme Court.
Talking with Sarah Turberville, director of the Constitution Project, you can join in about the high court. Do you have confidence in the Supreme Court, or do you think it has become too political? What reforms do you think are needed? And if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, what will make you respect the institution more or less? 800-642-1234. Sarah, let's explore term limits. One reform that some people have put forward is by having the justices be under term limits, and your organization has advocated for them. What are you calling for?
So term limits are a way to both ensure the independence of the decision-making of judges, but also as a way to inject a little bit more of democratic decision-making into the court as well. So you've got 9 people on the Supreme Court now. Our recommendation, and the recommendation of numerous experts on the right and the left, has been that each would serve an 18-year term limit. And what that would do for a 9-person bench is that it would essentially enable a president to appoint 2 justices every term of their presidency for every 4 years. And the idea behind this is that 18 years is a long time. And that is
18 years is a long time for any job.
That's right. I mean, think about it, right? There's nobody in our government who holds a job for life except for federal judges. And it has a very anti-democratic flavor to it. And I think if we were to create a system, today from scratch, that we would not look at lifetime tenure as being a good thing. But an 18-year term is something that would still allow for the justices to sort of accumulate wisdom over the course of their time on the bench, which is what you want any good judge to do. And it would also inject a little bit more routine into the confirmation process, because one of the things that happens with sort of the random nature of confirmations now is that it becomes sort of a winner take all kind of endeavor for politicians. And it's also resulted in an incredibly lopsided, just by happenstance, but an incredibly lopsided rate of appointment between Republican presidents and Democratic presidents. So going back to, the 60s, if you look at, say, from the Johnson administration to present, Republican presidents have had like a greater opportunity for appointment of justices than Democratic presidents, even though they have occupied White House for approximately the same amount of time during those 5 decades, or 6 decades.
And I want to get more into the confirmation process ahead of our news break here. I just want to quickly ask you, what about caveats like deaths or unexpected retirements when you look at term limits?
Yeah, so, you know, there's definitely a lot of, there's a number of kind of technicalities like that that would have to be
ironed out,
worked out, mm-hmm. that would have to be ironed out. There's a variety of different proposals, and we could go into the weeds of some of that that would address it. But, you know, I think with an 18-year term limit, you're much less likely to see retirements from the bench before the term limit is up. Mm. And in addition, you know, an 18-year limit would, you know, I think there would be less concern about people holding on to those 18 years until they become octogenarians.
I think
would dissipate too.
We're going to pause here. We'll pick this up with Sarah Turberville after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on how to reform the Supreme Court, what that looks like on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden, in his remarks last month on the retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer, said he would seek a candidate with the Senate's advice and consent.
Choosing someone to sit in the Supreme Court, I believe, is one of the most serious constitutional responsibility a president has. Our process is going to be rigorous. I will select a nominee worthy of Justice Breyer's legacy of excellence and decency.
What qualities should presidents look for in a Supreme Court nominee? Whom do you hope President Biden nominates? 800-642-1234. Sarah Turberville directs the Constitution Project at the nonpartisan group Project on Government Oversight, and she's with us for the hour. So, Sarah, I want to talk about the confirmation process and the confirmation process. It's become increasingly contentious in these decades, very political. And it was amazing because Justice Ginsburg was confirmed by a near, 96-3 vote in 93. But more recent nominations have really triggered this anger and division and tit-for-tat behavior. What is happening?
I think we're seeing a variety of things come together at the same time. There's, you know, the increasing polarization of the country has, I think, led to Supreme Court selection also becoming incredibly salient in electoral politics. So now you've got, you know, presidents who run on the fact that they would select a judge who would uphold Roe v. Wade or overturn Roe v. Wade. There's, you know, polling indicates that in presidential elections, Supreme Court, like what that candidate would do with a Supreme Court vacancy, rises to the top of a pretty significant, you know, number of voters' minds when they go into the polling booth. So I think that's one of the major things that's going on here. And again, I would just, you know, suggest to your listeners that all of that goes back to the concentration of power at the court. You know, it's, and that's why kind of reimagining what this court could look like so that we'd shift those incentives is such an important thing for us to do.
Justice Breyer announcing last month he's retiring after his successor is confirmed. Are you expecting a bitter fight over the nomination and confirmation process?
In this case, I would be surprised if it was bitter. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's the Democrats hold the majority of the Senate barely. And we've even seen a handful of Republicans come out and say that they would probably support the president's nominee, thinking through the three judges that have sort of risen to the top of the list, all of whom are, I think, by any stretch of the imagination, eminently qualified to serve. So I'm not anticipating this to be that bitter. And part of that is because this is not something that's going to change the composition of the court.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But with a breakdown of the confirmation process, a spiraling of the politics of these confirmations and how they drag out, can rules-based changes make any lasting impact here on how these confirmations happen?
I certainly don't think that the Senate is going to engage in de-escalation around Supreme Court nominations. And so, and that's why, you know, our work has not focused on rules changes to say, bring back the filibuster for judicial nominations. I mean, those things are gone, and I don't think they're coming back. But instead, I think that's why it's so important for us to look at, like, what is it that is driving the confirmation process into such toxic territory, and for us to work towards shifting those incentives. And so that's why sort of changing the structure of the Supreme Court itself is, you know, what I think people's attention should be focused on.
Really getting at the root of the problem, instead of making things that could possibly change things slightly, but not really, or not have a very lasting consequence. We're talking with Sarah Turberville, director of the Constitution Project, looking at reforms. What's possible for the Supreme Court, where you see it headed? 800-642-1234 to join in. Russ is joining us from Holman. Hi, Russ. Go ahead.
Hello. How are you?
Doing well. What is on your mind about the Supreme Court?
Well, basically, I guess what I wanted to say is that I don't object at all to if there are term limits, whether it's the 18 years or something of that nature. However, I do agree with your first caller that with regards to the Supreme Court, I believe their only role is to interpret the law as it pertains to the Constitution of the United States. And I see the right, if you will, the Republican side picking candidates or trying to pick nominees that adhere to the Constitution of the United States and will go that way, where I see the left or the Democrats trying to pick candidates or nominees that will in fact rewrite the law. And that's not the role of the Supreme Court. It is to interpret the Constitution of the United States. And that's really all I have to say.
Well, Russ, while we have you on the line here, what changes would you back? I hear you supporting term limits. What else might be something that you think the Supreme Court should take up and change in some way?
Well, I'm not sure that it needs to be changed, quite frankly. I mean, I believe that 9 is an adequate amount of judges.
Okay.
And that way there's not going to be a tie, such as if you had the 10. I didn't realize that we had 10 Supreme Court judges at one time. That's information I did not know. So I left 9. I don't think we need to have more than 9. I'll certainly support 18 years. I think you're with 9 and every 2 years approximately, there's a chance for everybody, if the retirements and the deaths fall in the right order, that's the way it would end up happening, is a president would get to pick or nominate a nominee every term. But, I don't see anything wrong with the way it is right now, except that I want the judges to do what I believe their job is, and that is to interpret the laws based upon the Constitution of the United States. Your guest said about it was brought to their attention that they should throw out Obamacare. That wasn't why it was brought to their attention. It was brought to their attention to see if it was constitutional. That's all.
Russ, thank you. Sarah, go ahead.
Well, I'm happy to hear that term limits is something that makes sense to the caller. I think that is a sentiment that many people possess. It doesn't make sense for somebody to hold a position for life in a democratic system of governance. And that's why if you look at just within the United States, for example, there's every single state requires either has a term limit for their justices on their state Supreme Courts, or has a retirement age. I think Rhode Island might be the only state that doesn't have either one of those things. And then if you look around at some of our peer democracies, you would see a similar type of limitation. But I would encourage folks to kind of think about why it is that Supreme Court decision-making has come to loom so large in our political discourse and in the lives of Americans. And is that, you know, is it nine people making these decisions that, is that something we should really be that comfortable with?
Let's also look at the Supreme Court getting to decide which cases it will hear, which ones it won't. What impact does that have in its power?
So this is an interesting proposal too. So the Supreme Court possesses not just the power to decide cases, but the power to decide which cases it's going to hear. And, you know, for many, that is the power to sort of set an agenda, right? If you can select not maybe the cases that are most important or that, you know, where you've got, say, one part of the country, you know, this specific rule applies to them, and another part of the country, a different rule applies. But instead, you've got just the views of the justices about which cases they would like to hear, that's an enormous amount of power. So one of the proposals is to inject more independent review over which cases the court ought to hear. And so some of them have looked to asking maybe a panel of state Supreme Court judges and federal circuit court judges, which is the body of judges right below the Supreme Court, to make recommendations to the Supreme Court about which cases it ought to hear, so that it diffuses a little some of that power of Supreme Court justices to potentially set, you know, an agenda for the types of cases that they want to see brought to the court. Hmm. So that they can issue some seminal kind of decision or overturn precedent.
That's interesting. Let's go to Craig now in Onalaska with an idea. Hi, Craig. Go ahead.
Good morning. My view is that the law is supposed to be neutral in its application, and our present system doesn't allow for that. So part of my solution would be to allow the American Bar Association to have a pool of candidates that the president picks from, instead of going out and picking somebody who has extreme views but is okay on the presidential side. You have maybe a more likely chance of getting neutral judges by having the American Bar Association have this pool.
Craig, thank you. Sarah, what about the ABA?
Well, the ABA has historically had a fairly prominent role in the vetting of Supreme Court nominations. And, you know, so I would absolutely, and there's a judicial selection committee at the American Bar Association that reviews Supreme Court nominees and, you know, provides a rating of them as, you know, very highly qualified, qualified, or not qualified. And various presidents have used the ABA system at sort of different points in the nomination process. I think what your caller's pointing to is this idea of merit selection, which is something that has taken hold in a number of states and is something that, you know, was the very first recommendation in our report that we issued last summer. And the idea is to have a collection of individuals who vet these nominees and are looking at them through sort of independent criteria related to, you know, judicial temperament, integrity, generosity of thought, commitments to the well-being of their communities, demographic diversity, along with what we would consider sort of like, you know, academic and intellectual rigor. So
what I'm hearing is a much more holistic look at a person.
That's right. And I would, you know, going back to the 1970s, President Carter, he had, the Congress had passed a big bill that expanded the lower court judiciary. So there were a number of circuit court positions that were created, and these positions had to be filled. And President Carter did not fill them with sort of his own selections about who would be the good, you know, who might be a proponent of a judicial philosophy that he agreed with. Instead, he outsourced it to a merit selection committee who ultimately developed a slate of nominees that then he selected.
We have attorney Sarah Turberville, director of the Constitution Project, expert on access to justice, on fair courts, the protection of constitutional rights. Still time to talk about how and why to reform the Supreme Court, what you would see it look like. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Sarah Turberville here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with attorney Sarah Turberville with the Nonpartisan Project on Government Oversight. She coordinates their work in the areas of democratic institutions, separation of powers, protection of constitutional rights. Do you think structural reform of the high court is within reach? What are the prospects, short and long term? 800-642-1234. Sarah Turberville with us for about seven more minutes. So almost all of the proposals to reform the court on the table would require like a passage of a new law, or some may require a constitutional amendment. How do you affect change in the court and how it functions?
Well, I think what's kind of ironic in this discussion is that one of the most controversial proposals, court expansion, is, you know, arguably the one that would be the easiest to implement because Congress has set the number of seats at the Supreme Court. And, you know, it's people debate whether or not term limits is something that the Congress could impose on the Supreme Court, or if that's something that has to be done by constitutional amendment. Our position is that term limits is actually something that could be done by an act of Congress, because the idea around an 18-year term limit is not that the justices would then sort of cease being an Article III judge, an Article III meaning Article III of the Constitution, but that they would then roll onto a circuit court, for example, if they wanted to remain within the federal judiciary. So they would not be deprived of their ability to continue serving as a judge. They would technically still be holding their position for good behavior. They just would not be serving on the Supreme Court. And the last note I would add on that is practically that's actually what's happened with recent justices who have retired from the Supreme Court. Justice Souter, for example, still sits on the First Circuit Court of Appeals and hears cases. Justice O'Connor did it for some time as well after she stepped down from the bench. So there's a couple different approaches here that could be pursued.
So is this more of a rotating panel type concept that would reform it? Or, you know, a panel of judges, like a pool of judges that rotate through?
Well, that's a separate proposal.
That is a separate, okay.
Yeah, and I'm happy to speak about that briefly. The President's Commission addressed this too, where, you know, we could imagine a Supreme Court that is not a fixed sort of number or a fixed identity of a justice who is nominated specifically for the Supreme Court. Instead, we could have a court that is comprised of, sort of random selection of justices from the circuit court level, which frankly is where many of the current Supreme Court justices came from to begin with. And there's over like two, you know, about 200 of those positions across the federal judiciary on the circuit court level. And so that could also have the function of sort of like diffusing the concentration of power held by this single individual for such a long period of time.
Kind of like your numbers up, jury duty, you know.
You know, there used to be kind of the, there was a version of this in the early days of the Republic where justices did something which they called riding circuit, which is they went and they sat on the circuit courts as well.
Let's go to Greg in Park Falls. Greg, hi.
Good morning, ladies. Great show of the day. I have a question. Why not just elect our justices the same way we elect our congressmen, senators, and governors?
Greg, thank you for that. And Sarah, again, I think you're going to drive home the point that that isn't a good idea in your mind.
That's right. And I think for, you know, it comes down to not wanting our judges to have political constituencies. We want them to be above the political fray. And that's why ideas like, you know, merit selection are things that we really endorse, because the judiciary really is in this way quite different from the other two political branches.
So in your crystal ball, in our last moments together, what do you think will happen if the high court isn't reformed in some way?
Well, I do think that we are about to, you know, experience an inflection point with what the court decides to do with Roe v. Wade. And then I think that we, depending upon what happens with that, I think it's likely that we will see a public that is potentially extremely galvanized around Supreme Court reform. You know, and I can't predict which, you know, which of these ideas might be the ones that sort of take root. But I do think that people by the end of the Supreme Court term could be quite sort of fed up and at a breaking point around the status quo.
So if the court were to overrule Roe, you see that that being a severe blow on the credibility of the court?
I think in the minds of, you know, many who have wanted to see Roe upheld and protected for years, and that would be the outcome. And, you know, frankly, I feel like the public being galvanized around, you know, what is wrong with the current structure of the court, where there's this concentration of power in so few people for so long, would maybe be a good thing, and that there are plenty of models in within the United States and among our peer democracies that would be a good place for us to look to restructure how we think about this institution.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah Turberville, Director of the Constitution Project, part of the Project on Government Oversight. We have a link at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.